Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We all acknowledge this legislation is a tremendous step forward. Why? Because it saves lives, saves money, and protects Medicare, makes Medicare stronger.
Well, the health care reform bill process took another major step forward late last night. As with all these steps, this is by no means a guarantee of passage. But Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, who we heard in that clip, has now introduced an actual bill intended to start a full Senate floor debate. The next trick will be getting 60 senators to vote in the next few days to even open that debate. Like the bill that passed in the House, this one requires most businesses to offer coverage and most individuals to buy it, and it stops insurance companies from denying coverage based on pre-existing conditions. Shayla Murray is following the health bill for The Washington Post and will help us break down the politics and what's different in this on a policy level from the House bill, which is actually kind of a lot, including differences on taxes, abortion rights, illegal immigrant rights, and a public option insurance plan. So, Shayla Murray, welcome back to WNYC. Thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you.
First, explain to our listeners the beautiful contradiction that Harry Reid likes to point out, crowing about today. The bill would spend $850 billion to expand health insurance over the next 10 years, but the Congressional Budget Office projects it would reduce the federal deficit over that time by $130 billion. How can we spend that much more on something while spending that much less?
Well, good question. That happens a lot in Washington. The trick here is to provide more coverage to more people while lowering the overall cost of healthcare, making it cheaper to provide that coverage. So this bill is on two missions, parallel missions that hopefully, if they get it right, will meet at a certain point and really start to affect this overall major economic problem that the country faces, which are these out-of-control health care costs. And this bill has several provisions in it that the House bill doesn't have in it that are aimed directly at that goal. One, namely, this tax on expensive insurance policies. We call them Cadillac plans. These are very generous health care policies that a lot of executives have, a lot of union workers have them as well. They've negotiated coverage, along with their wage packages. And this, the theory economists believe, this leads to the overuse of healthcare services, that people will run off to specialists or check every last thing just because their insurance company pays for it. So the thinking is if you can restrict people from or restrict the healthcare choices that they're making in a way that doesn't affect their health overall, that will help drive down usage, drive down costs, and make the system work more rationally. There are a whole host of changes as well to the Medicare system aimed at the same outcome, where, in Medicare, you have layer upon layer upon layer of protocols that have been established to treat various illnesses, chronic conditions, diseases that older people get and carry with them throughout, 20 years or whatever. And this bill, as does the House bill, attempts to come up with more rational ways of treating illnesses, of mandating certain types of tests and whatnot, in order to create more coherence in the healthcare system and make it cost less ultimately. So what the CBO report, the analysis we got last night, suggests is that the bill, the Senate bill, as does the House bill, but the Senate bill a little bit more effectively, seems to drive down some of those costs while also providing this enormous coverage expansion, to about 31 million Americans who don't have coverage.
Well, it's really interesting. And I guess the tax structure is that the tax on the so-called Cadillac health care plans replaces what the House had, which was an income tax hike on individuals making $500,000 a year or couples making more than a million, correct?
Correct. And that, that's a popular tax with Democrats. It doesn't affect very many people. But it also doesn't have any long-term positive budget implications the way this Cadillac tax is. I mean, a lot of economists and some fiscal conservatives would love to get rid of that tax exemption for health care benefits entirely because it, you know, it creates these sort of distorted decision making.
They say distorted economic incentives because
exactly.
Instead of paying people more wages, which are taxed as income, they can give them very expensive health care plans, which are not taxed as income because benefits in general are not taxed as income. But, by the way, I think these senators are showing their age by calling them Cadillac plans.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, today's best-selling luxury cars are BMWs and Audis and Mercedes. But that aside, there is a contradiction here, right? I mean, the Democrats are promising better coverage for people while taxing to discourage employers from providing the best policies.
Well, exactly. And there is this sort of fundamental question at the root of this debate, which is, what's the best way to deliver health coverage to people? Is it through the employer system that we've all known throughout our lives and several generations now? Or is it to create these individual marketplaces and encourage people to shop around for the policies that make most sense for them, their families, their stage of life? And this bill creates this new, as does the House bill, creates this new individual marketplace where people who don't have, you know, say you work a couple of part-time jobs or you're self-employed or you work for a very small business or you're just independently wealthy and you don't have access to health care through an employer. You can go out on this insurance exchange and buy policies at basically group rates pooled together with, you know, an entire state's worth of population or whatever, however they organize it, and, you know, and get your policies at cheaper rates. So in the House bill, I haven't looked at the CBO numbers for the Senate bill on this, but in the House bill, about 9 million people would opt out of their insurance coverage through their employer and into the exchange as a result of this. And that's a very interesting migratory path that a lot of people who have studied healthcare economics over, you know, the last decade or so think is the right way to go ultimately, where people are disentangled from their employer and, you know, are able to go out and, but it's a generational issue too. I mean, people who have been in the system now for 30, 40 years are not going to feel comfortable with that, but a lot of younger people might. So
you think the bill is designed to make people migrate, to use your words, over a generation, out of employer coverage, to kind of even let employers off the hook unless they want to use health coverage as some incentive in labor-tight markets?
Well, exactly.
And turn it into an individual responsibility?
Well, this yes, but not in order to let employers off the hook so much as to bring the market forces that generally shake out, you know, that determine real estate prices and car prices and everything else, that bring those market forces to bear on healthcare. Because right now, individuals basically have no control over either the coverage they have or what they pay for it. And if you create an individual marketplace, even a small one, as this both these bills would that grow into a more, you know, diverse and marketplace of people of all ages shopping aggressively? And would, you know, that's the whole gamble, that ultimately that would drive down costs over time.
And then these exchanges that are being set up at the state level or the regional level or whatever it turns out to be, would have to be robust enough to have many private insurers in them, plus maybe a public option, but at least many private insurers in them to really provide competition, because that's not really what we have right now. We have in so many places just a few insurers offering a few options, and people feel really caught between a rock and a hard place if they're buying individual insurance or even if their company's buying insurance for their workers. Is there anything in this that would really create more competition on those exchanges, or would people be stuck with the same choices that we have now?
Well, that's, you know, another big question. The thinking is that the marketplace now reflects the way it's structured, and that if you restructure it, you'll get a different marketplace. And we saw this, for instance, with when Congress added a drug benefit to Medicare a few years ago, and Republicans who created this benefit were just paralyzed with fear that insurance companies would not offer these plans and that they would be too expensive, and they created this public option fallback that would be, you know, that would come into place if plans didn't bloom up in all these different marketplaces. Well, they did, and folks ended up with 30 or 40 different choices, even in, you know, rural communities and not just in the big cities where there are a lot of insurance providers now. But so that's the expectation, is that as the rules are changed and the opportunities come along, that insurance companies will take advantage of them. And they don't have, you know, these individual marketplaces just simply don't exist now. So there's really no incentive to offer good deals to, say, you know, a 30-year-old.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the classic self-employed business consultant with his family is paying like $15,000 a year now for a policy that, you know, basically only covers catastrophic events like, you know, operations and that sort of thing.
Right. And if there's no incentive to offer good insurance to a 30-year-old, there's really no incentive to offer good insurance to a 55-year-old.
Right.
Which is, you know, a lot of the people who are getting laid off in this recession who are having the hardest time finding affordable health insurance. So we'll
right.
see how well it does with that. But this is WNYC. My guest is Shayla Murray, who has the front page Washington Post article today, breaking down the Harry Reid version of the health reform bill, which he's trying to get onto the Senate floor in the next couple of days. All 40 Republicans are expected to vote against bringing the bill to the floor. Senator Judd Gregg, for example, said the bill, quote, may claim to be deficit neutral, but it uses sleight of hand budgetary tricks by assuming unrealistic tax increases and Medicare cuts that members of Congress will not be willing to follow through on. What are the Medicare cuts he's referring to? Is this what you were starting to describe before?
Right. There are up to about $400 billion worth of adjustments to Medicare, not necessarily cuts per se, but changes in Medicare cost structures and reimbursement methods and whatnot that would effectively take that amount of money out of the system. And
over 10 years,
and most of these things are steps that virtually everyone agrees have to be taken. And Judd Gregg himself has been rallying for years to enact entitlement reform and take.
You know, Shella, I'm glad you said that, and I want to linger on it for just a minute, because there's something I don't get about the Republicans suddenly being the party of generous Medicare benefits.
Yeah.
You know, health reform aside, Republicans have been saying for years that the growth in Medicare is unsustainable, that Medicare is much more broke than Social Security will ever be looking ahead 10 or 20 years. So normally they're clamoring to reduce Medicare expenses as the party of fiscal responsibility, aren't they?
Yes, and interestingly, the provision in here that the White House believes is the perhaps the most significant long-term measure that could affect the cost of health care is, it doesn't even cost any money in the bill. It's a new commission that would take the decision-making about Medicare out of the hands of Congress and put it in a separate, nonpartisan entity, sort of like a Federal Reserve Board type structure. And that, having covered Congress now for a number of years, watching these Medicare bills work their way through the system is really one of the most kind of vulgar displays of special interest politics that you will ever witness. I mean, it's worse than a road bill. These are, you know, if a lobbyist knows the right member and you know, can get, you know, a certain type of scan approved for reimbursement under Medicare, you know, voila, that costs the federal government $150 billion over 10 years and you know, it has no necessary medical benefit. So
have you been able to look at this 2,000-page Harry Reid health reform bill for that yet? I realize it just came out midnight.
That provision is in that. That was a hard-fought provision that is in this bill. It's not as strong as some people, as many in the White House would like it to be. But that's the sort of crack in the door that needs to be brushed wide open in order to really get a handle on this in the long term. And going back to entitlement reform, I mean, Judd Gregg and everybody else knows that these kind of practices and behavior simply have to end.
Mm. I'll tell you what, one thing that I hope the Republicans succeed in as they try to slow this bill down on the floor is the thing that some of them are talking about, to actually read the entire 2,000 pages of this bill on the Senate floor. Now, I gather that would take a number of days. I don't know if anybody has estimated the number of hours, but probably every bill should be read aloud on the Senate or the House floor to let people actually hear in public and see on C-SPAN what's in it and what are all the special interest little inserts and all of that stuff. So I hope that part at least comes to pass in slowing down the progress of the bill. There's about 6% of Americans who would not be insured under this bill, plus illegal immigrants. Do you know where that 6% number comes from?
The 6% are people whose they fall between a Medicaid eligibility, and they're low-income people who do not qualify for Medicaid but are, do not have enough income to purchase to be able to afford under this formula that they've concocted, insurance on the exchange, a policy on the open market. So they are exempted for various reasons. There's some religious exemptions, some exemptions for Native Americans, again, based on access, conscience decisions, and whatnot. But those are people who sort of fall between the cracks of and don't have access to affordable coverage. Again, don't qualify for Medicaid. An important thing to note on this bill is that it would vastly expand Medicaid, the biggest expansion since the program was created in 1965. And we talk all the time about this public option that would be in the bill that would compete alongside private plans in these insurance marketplaces. Well, under the Senate proposal that would allow states to opt out, not to participate in the public plan, only about 4 million people or so would buy this coverage. But I think about around 18 million people or so would enroll in Medicaid under this bill. Mm-hmm. So we talk a lot about the public option. There's a big, it's a big flashpoint politically. But in fact, at the heart of this bill is a huge Medicaid expansion that will have enormous impact, mainly in states like Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, Texas, low-income southern rural states that
they'll have limited Medicaid benefits now.
Very limited, limited social services.
We're just about out of time. There are some other things that I would like to talk about that we're not going to have time to the abortion issue, still a flashpoint, but this bill is a little better for abortion rights supporters than the House bill.
Mm-hmm.
This bill is a little softer on employers, I gather, who don't cover their workers.
Right, it's sort of a carrot approach.
So that might give employers the incentive to actually not cover more people and drive more people more quickly into that individual market. But just one question on the politics.
Mm-hmm.
This version by Harry Reid was written to get some specific waivers on board. Ben Nelson, Blanche Lincoln, Mary Landrieu, Joel Lieberman, Olympia Snow. Is it doing it?
Yes. Senator Reid is pretty confident that he's going to have the 60 votes he needs to bring this bill to the floor this weekend.
And that's just 60 votes to get it to the floor for a debate, right?
Who knew that was such a problem?
Right? So you have people like Joe Lieberman who are saying, I'll vote to bring it to the floor, and then I'm going to filibuster it.
Yes, and he has vowed to side with Republicans at the end of the line if this public option, depending
stays
on
in.
What this... But this is going to be, a really interesting month, and it's going to all be on C-SPAN. I mean, instead of in the back rooms and committee chambers and whatnot, this will be right on the Senate floor. Yep. It'll be a really interesting debate.
And a lot of it will be right here, too, because we will be dipping in and out of that debate the entire time that it goes on and bringing people highlights and continuing to look in great detail at the health care reform process as it goes through Congress, as we've done all the way along. And I want to thank Shayla Murray for her reporting, front page of the Washington Post today on this, and for coming on with us. Thank you so much.
You bet. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.